Blog Talk Radio.
For Thursday, August 23rd, 2012. And tonight, we feature a discussion by your host, Pope Runyon, that's myself, on the first century Alexandrian connection, where the elements that make up the Western esoteric tradition, that's the Hermetic tradition, came together and began the synthesis that was finally codified by Abbot Trithemius and Cornelius Agrippa in the 16th century. Now we'll trace the Pythagorean, ancient Egyptian, Gnostic, Neoplatonic, biblical, Kabbalistic, alchemical, astrological, and even Christian influences that were shuffled together in a spiritual, intellectual ferment in what was perhaps the greatest university our Western world could boast of until the Age of Enlightenment. And we've dealt with this on previous broadcasts, but this time we'll focus on the particular people and their traditions. Alexander himself, the Ptolemies, and especially Ptolemy the astrologer, and Hypatia, the pagan martyr, Hermes Trismegistus, all three of them, and Marcus, the Valentinian, and Simon Magus. And we'll touch on the Greek Kabbalah, the Osiris myth, and the influence of Zoroaster. So if you have a burning desire to visit the Library of Alexandria, then join us, but no smoking inside, please. Now, We've dealt with this Alexandria before, and off and on several times. You can't have a show on the Western esoteric tradition without mentioning Alexandria often. And the reason for that is that Alexandria, as we have just said, was the place and the time that's from a couple hundred years before Christ, a couple hundred years after. It's the place, the time and the place where the Western esoteric tradition, as we know it today, was formed. Now, this includes both the Hermetic tradition, the alchemical, astrological, and also the Kabbalistic, because, as we will get into, they all have their origin and their flowering and their synthesis in this magnificent and, for its time, huge city. One of the first of what we might call modern cities. Now, that's part and parcel of what caused a lot of things, including Gnosticism. And, of course, Christianity is, although I'm sure that Christians kind of want to avoid this, but it is a form of Gnosticism, and we might say that it's the form of Gnosticism that won out over several others. But it got started in Alexandria, actually, even intellectually it did, and it had an influence. It was influenced by the Hermetic tradition, and then it continued in its own influence. Let's go back, though, to how it all got started. Alexander the Great, who was a student of Aristotle, along with being quite a military genius, Alexander the Great, back in 400, around from the middle of the 4th century BC, set out after the Persian Empire reached its peak and kind of blunted itself trying to take over Greece. Alexander, who was a Macedonian, a northern Greek, they were the hardier breed at that time. He decided to reverse the situation and go and conquer Asia and spread Greek culture. And he did exactly that, as I'm sure all of you know. He marched a Macedonian Greek army all the way to India and all the way up into Afghanistan and conquered Persia and Babylon and Palestine and Syria and the whole. He literally Hellenized the whole Middle East and all the way up through Turkey and into Afghanistan and all the way into Western India, and spread Hellenic Greek culture everywhere he went. And the evidences of that are still around today. And, of course, they refer to him in India as Iskandar. And there are many legends of him. He believed that he was a god, and, I suppose in some ways you might say maybe he was, but at least a god among men. And he wanted to found a city in Egypt that would be a center of Greek culture in the Mediterranean. And he did. And in 331 B.C., and he founded Alexandria on the coast of Egypt, on the Mediterranean coast. Now, Alexandria, because Alexander and the Greeks were literally the rulers of the whole Mediterranean and the whole an empire the size of the later Roman Empire. And frankly, if there hadn't been an Alexandrian Greek Empire, there wouldn't have been a Roman Empire. We really can, the Roman Empire is, in a way, kind of an extension almost of what Alexander originally established. And so Alexandria, which he founded, became a center of learning for the world, all the way from India and Afghanistan, all the way and Italy, of course, because the Greeks had colonies all over Italy and the Mediterranean, and so it became a great urban center and a center for trade because it was a seaport, and they had the great lighthouse there, and they had a wonderful harbor. And the most important thing about it, though, from our point of view, is that it became the intellectual and spiritual capital of the world. And they founded a, first it started with a library, and this library grew to become actually a university. And people came from all over the world to study there. Now, a few things that we need to mention about Alexandria to give you the idea of how all of this synthesis, this Hermetic synthesis, came about. Alexandria had a couple of foreign quarters. Now they had the largest population of Jewish people in the world at that time, and it was in Alexandria. But they had a Jewish quarter. Well, I suppose you could call it a ghetto, but they didn't call it one there. It was the Jewish quarter, and they had an Egyptian quarter and a Greek, but the city was primarily Greek and Greco-Egyptian. So this Alexandria is where a type of religious expression, philosophical and religious expression, began, and that this is called Gnosticism. And one of the things about Gnosticism that we need to explain is that Gnosticism, and of course Christianity is, as I say, is the form of Gnosticism that won out. Gnosticism was a direct result of urbanization. And so you can say, in a sense, that Alexandria was the first great modern city, because you had huge areas that might be called tenements or slums or whatever, and you had a lot of manufacturing and all kinds of things that go on in an urban center that you don't have out there in the rural community. Now, this, of course, when Alexandria was founded and when it grew, this was pagan. This was pagan times, and you had slavery, and you had numerous pagan gods and creeds. But most of these pagan creeds, most of these religions, were based on the agricultural cycle. You know, our Canaanite seasonal ceremonies, of course, are based on the agricultural cycle and vegetation and that sort of thing. But, you know, when you get a big city and people leave the farm and they come to the city and they want to find work and various trades and various jobs that you have in a city, they lose touch with the land. And they lose touch with the seasons. The seasons don't mean that much. It's just that you're hotter in the summertime and you're wetter in the wintertime, or some are colder. But other than that, you're out of touch. You're out of touch with nature. And you're out of touch with the round of the seasons and the vegetation and the livestock and the various aspects of nature. So paganism that had a rural agricultural base to it didn't satisfy these people anymore. They were looking for something more transcendental, something that was not nature-oriented, something that gave them a hope for salvation. Oh, boy. Give me something to get me loose, to loose me from this urban sprawl, this anomie, this miserable existence here in this city. And sure enough, I mean, we had pollution and everything. Almost all of the problems that we have in cities today, they had then. So Alexandria was one of the first great Western cities, and so out of this matrix of human misery, if you want to call it that, disconnected from nature, arose these religions, and because of this large Jewish community there, and because of the connection with that, there was a lot of biblical interest in, and the Gnostics concentrated quite a bit on the Bible. They had apocryphal versions of it and all of that, and all kinds of different biblical books that weren't in the Bible and whatever. And then they created a number of rather strange, convoluted versions of what we know as the Bible. But Gnosticism was, to many degrees, biblical, and it had, of course, also it borrowed from Zoroaster, and it borrowed from some aspects from ancient Egypt and whatever. But essentially, Gnosticism rose up as an urban kind of let's escape from this awful existence, and let's find a nice heaven. And this is not something that pagan that rural pagans were not concerned with, this sort of thing, but these Gnostics were. So consequently, you had a built-in kind of a crucible here that would produce these various biblical type ideas of salvation and transcendental, the soul ascending to the sphere of bliss and all of this. This finds a fertile ground in Alexandria. Now, at the same time, this is going on, in the Greek area, we have to realize that the Greeks had already had, say, about 200 years earlier, around 500 B.C., maybe 550 B.C., the Greeks had had some kind of connection, we think, with Central Asian shamans or something or other, and they'd gotten very mystical, and they had developed a cult called the Orphic tradition, and in which the soul ascended through the spheres it was similar to and had an influence on the Gnostic idea. And this of course, also kind of married up with the Pythagorean idea that the Greeks had. That's Empedocles and Pythagoras and Parmenides and Hipparchus and Eurystheus. They conceived of a universe that was that had a cosmic structure, a geometric, mathematical, musical, a harmony and a mystical structure that went all the way from the earth all the way out to the farthest reach of the universe that they could come up with. Now, into this mix, we have astrology, which came in from Babylon originally, but as far as we know. But then the Egyptians also had a later version of it, and the Greeks picked it up from the Babylonians, and Alexandria became the center of astrological, the collection of astrological data. Now, one of the Ptolemies, they were probably the last of the Ptolemies, I think. And he came along after Christ, actually, about 70 years after Jesus. This last Ptolemy, who was the great astrologer, who collected all of this astrological data, which they'd been collecting at the library anyway. But Ptolemy, he literally created modern, what we would refer to as modern tropical astrology. I mean, he was the grandfather of it. He wrote two books, the Almagest and the Tetrabiblos, both of which are still in print, and both of which are still quite good, even though he was a little foggy on the precession of the equinoxes, but he was working on it. He was getting there. He had a concept of it. And he also, of course, he was geocentric, but then on the other hand, tropical astrology can be geocentric and still work. You know, Copernicus is all very enlightening and all of that, but you don't really need Copernicus because tropical astrology is essentially geocentric anyway. So Ptolemy's was the creator of modern astrology, and that figures into the Hermetic tradition very, 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 very heavily. Now, the Gnostics, for the most part, were dualists. They were dualistic, and this was a religion that really appealed, like early Christianity did, appealed to people who were down and out and miserable. And, you know, this world's awful, but the next world's going to be great. You know, that kind of appeal. So Gnosticism had a tendency to be very dualistic. In other words, this world is a prison planet. It's a terrible place. It's awful. And that the God of this world, and he might even be Jehovah in some Gnostic ideas, and the God of this planet is an evil demiurge, and the good God, the great Father, is way, way out across the universe, and he's going to send the messenger, the paraclete, the Christ child, or whatever you want to call him. He's going to send the messenger, and the messenger is going to give you the formulas and give you the secrets of how to get back across the abyss and escape from being reincarnated on this in this terrible existence here. Now, I know this sounds a little bit like Buddhism, but there are some differences. But essentially, though, Gnosticism was a dualistic proposition. Whereas the world's terrible, and even God of the world is terrible, and let's get loose and let's send our soul back. Now, Christianity is, of course, a Gnostic sect. And if you don't think so, just think about the doctrine of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Well, the Father is way back across the abyss. The Son comes to give you the Word, and the Holy Ghost is the Spirit within you. And so there's no big mystery in the Christian Trinity as long as you understand Gnosticism. The Gnostics, however, they had a 3 degrees, the Hylics, the Psychics, and the Pneumatics. And the Christians decided that they were going to substitute faith for the 3rd degree. And so they did, and that gave them a lot more power. And then they deified their messenger, made him a god. That was Constantine's idea. And that gave them even more power. And so they became the largest religion in the world based upon the fact that they no longer claimed to really know. They just had faith. That's one of the reasons why fundamental Christians don't like Masons, is because Masons have a 3rd degree. But this all got started in Alexandria. And one of the things that you need to realize about this is that Greek philosophy figured into this, because the Orphic hymns, as you probably know from having read some of them, and if you're familiar with Orphic philosophy, it's very mystical. The soul, when you pass on, goes up through the spheres and drinks from the spring of memory, and then goes to the blessed fields, and then may return down through the gate of the gods and be reborn. Possibly all of this was Orphic mysticism, and this anti-Pythagorean cosmology married up with a strain of philosophy that we would refer to as Neoplatonic. Now, you're familiar, of course, with Plato, and Plato had a philosophy that was actually Pythagorean. It really was. It's been said that Plato was a closet Pythagorean. Actually, that's true. But Plato theorized, but didn't make it very practical. And then along came later in Alexandria a form of Platonism, which are referred to as Neoplatonism, in which they put the magic back into Plato, and you had emanations descending, emanations. This figures into the Kabbalah, by the way. Now, meanwhile, remember now, here in Alexandria, you have this huge Jewish community, this great big ghetto full of very smart Jewish people. And they, there's a little story on that, they had many years previously lost the only Torah that they had left after captivity. And somebody had brought one to the Library of Alexandria. Now, one of the things that you had to do, and one of the reasons why the library was so great, was because in order to be accepted as a graduate student, or as, you know, as a real scholar at the university, at the library, you had to bring a manuscript. You had to bring a manuscript that the library didn't have. And then you submitted that manuscript to be copied for the library, and then you could be accepted as a fellow of the, you know, of the university and of the library. And so people brought manuscripts from all over the world, and that's one of the ways the library became so great. And all of these manuscripts had to be translated into Greek. Now, this is one of the great things that Alexander, an egotistical young firebrand, self-deified Alexander, this is one of the great things that he did, at least from our perspective. He made the whole known world, except perhaps the Chinese and the, you know, and a few others, speak Greek. Greek, it became the language of the civilized world. And it remained the language of the civilized world all the way up through the Roman era. All the way up, Greek was everything that was worth knowing was in Greek. And this was one of Alexander's accomplishments. He made us all read and speak Greek. So if you brought a manuscript from India or from, you know, from China, I suppose, or wherever you brought this manuscript from, it got translated into Greek and it got put in the library. And so that library was, of course, as you know, it got burned about four times. And that library, if we had it in its full form, if we had that library in its full form, Wikipedia would have to look up and say, oh my gosh, I wish we had that, because it was, you know, like a gigantic Wikipedia of the ancient world, and we only have what has actually survived. There's only bits and pieces of it. And the bits and pieces are amazing, but imagine if we had the whole thing. And so the scholars of the various traditions and religions, they had all of this library that they could study. It was there. It was available. And so Alexandria became a birthplace of all kinds of religious cults and all kinds of place of philosophical ramifications and everything. It was a stew pot of spiritual and intellectual knowledge and wisdom and whatever. And Gnosticism was also very influential on the Kabbalah and Greek and Pythagorean philosophy and Pythagorean cosmological structure was also very, very influential on the Jewish Kabbalah. And don't take my word for that. Gershom Scholem frankly admits that. Now, so what the Jewish Kabbalah becomes, and it kind of grows out of this Alexandrian matrix, because remember now, they have the largest Jewish community out in the world at that time. Now, that Torah that they lost in the captivity, somebody before then had taken one to Alexandria, and it had been copied into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. Now, when the Jews came back, they didn't have it. They had to take the Greek copy and recopy it into Hebrew. Yeah. Now, the Samaritans claim that they have one that's very, very old and all that. But nobody's ever substantiated that. The truth of the matter is that the earliest Torah was in Greek because it had been copied from one that was lost. And so you have Greco-Egyptian because the last, Egyptian hieroglyphics were almost unreadable. By the time the Ptolemies came in, by the time Alexandria was founded, there were very few Egyptians who could read hieroglyphics. And one of the things the Ptolemies did, and they were forever in their debt for doing it, was that they got the few Egyptians that could read the hieroglyphics and said, hey, we'll pay you. Sit down and start copying. Start copying, start translating into Greek so we can save the hearing. Well, as a result of that, they were able to preserve the Isis and Osiris legend. And this was the main legend that got preserved from ancient Egypt. And so much of it was lost. But at least the Isis and Osiris legend survived. And so you have it, Egyptian influence. And by the way, the ancient Greeks were they really venerated the ancient Egyptians. The Pythagorean and Platonic Greeks, I mean, they just felt that if you were an educated man way back 500 B.C., you were an educated man, you went to Egypt and you studied with the Egyptian priests. And of course, very, very quickly on, after 500 B.C., in a few hundred years, there was hardly anybody left in Egypt that could read hieroglyphics. It was really tragic. But at least there was enough of an Egyptian tradition that it really did have an influence on the Hermetic tradition. You know, Hermes Trismegistus is supposed to be Thoth-Hermes, it's supposed to be Egyptian, and it purports to be ancient Egyptian. Well, for a long, long time, people thought, oh, come on, this isn't ancient Egyptian, this is just Egyptified Greek. Well, no, actually, the Hermetic tradition does. Recent scholarship has established that the Hermetic tradition does owe quite a bit to ancient Egypt, and perhaps even to Akhenaten. We're not sure of that, but I mean, but it certainly does owe a great deal of its wisdom to the ancient Egyptians. So we still have to call it Greco-Egyptian, but still it does have a genuine ancient Egyptian base to it. Now the Hermes tradition. Some people think it's a form of Gnosticism. It really isn't. The Hermetic tradition is essentially Neoplatonic. It's essentially monist. It's essentially it not dualistic, but it is in some ways. But when you study the Hermetic tradition, you realize that it is a synthesis of the dualistic and the monistic concepts. There is no devil in the Hermetic tradition. There are demons and there are spirits and there are some of them aren't so good and whatever. It's our magical tradition, but it is not the earth is not an evil place, and nature is not evil. In fact, the Hermetic version of the fall is that man becomes enamored of his reflection in the mirror of nature, and he becomes more concerned with the physical. And this is the Hermetic way of saying that you should aspire to the higher, rather than saying that, like the Gnostics and some of the fundamental Christians, which say that, oh, the earth is an evil place that's ruled by the devil and all that kind of stuff. You've got to get me out. No. So the Hermetic tradition is much more Neoplatonic than it is Gnostic, although it does have some Gnostic elements, especially in its cosmology. Now, what was the Hermetic tradition and what is its relation to Alexandria? Well, but Christianity, of course, got started, and got going around. Really got going around 100 years after Christ, and really became a force to be reckoned with. And it was when it got started, even though it grew out of this Gnostic ferment and all of that. But Christianity was anti-intellectual, and it was how shall I put it? It was anti-cultural. It was the original Christian were zealots, and they were into self-mortification and anything that was pleasurable or tasted good or felt good or anything like that was evil, and they were just really insufferably intolerant people, and they especially didn't like intellectuals or anyone who speculated about anything or whatever. You accepted the Christian doctrine and you had faith and that was it. And if you didn't, well, so that's the way it got started. Now, granted, there were some Christians, some early Christians, who were philosophical and who were, the main movement was for the underprivileged and the miserable, and it was anti-intellectual. And so, the Hermetic tradition could be said to be classical paganism's last attempt to come up with something that was beautiful and was satisfying philosophically and was in tune with the highest principles of mysticism and intellectualism. And it was a competitor. Actually, the Hermetic tradition was an Alexandrian competitor to these dirty, unwashed, beady-eyed, romping, stomping, Bible-thumping Christians who were telling us, or waving their staffs in the air and telling us we were all going to hell and all of that. And now the best or worst example of this was one of the first pagan martyrs, and she was the daughter of Theon, who was the head librarian and the head and priest and the priest of Serapis in Alexandria. Serapis, by the way, was a composite god that they had created. Oh, they venerated him, very definitely, but they created a composite god, a philosophically composite god. The Hermetic people were very good at that, by the way, because Hermes said, the gods of the zodiac are eternal, but man creates the gods of the earth sphere, so go out and make some gods and make them work for you. Well, it's kind of similar to Tibetan Buddhism, too, in a way. However, Hypatia, Theon's daughter, was a mathematician of considerable ability. In fact, her theories of sectioning of cones are still used. I mean, in physics, I mean, she developed the theory of sectioning cones at angles, and she was finally, when her father died, or was murdered, actually. She took over the library, and she was the head librarian in Alexandria. Well, she would not convert to Christianity. She just absolutely refused, and politely and very, very nicely, but they kept pressuring her, because the Christians at that time, this was a couple hundred years after Christ. The Christians at that time were rioting and vandalizing everybody who wasn't a Christian. They were acting well, very much I'm not going to say. But anyway, they were being very, very obnoxious, and they wanted everybody to. And so, Hypatia, being the head librarian, and they wanted her very definitely to convert to Christianity, and she just said, I just simply can't. I can't accept this. So the archbishop gave Marcion permission to some zealots. What I mean by Marcion permission, this is when you... when you're in charge and you say something like, Well, King Henry and Becket's the best example, you know. King Henry is lying there on the floor of the castle with his barons, and they're all drunk, and Henry says, "Won't somebody rid me of this meddlesome priest?" And, of course, the barons are listening, drunk as they are, and so they go out and kill Becket, kill the archbishop right on the front steps of the church, and because Henry gave them Martian permission to do so. And so the archbishop of Alexandria gave Martian permission to this bunch of Christian zealots, and they dragged poor Hypatia out of her chariot on the way to the library one morning. They dragged her out and threw her down and eviscerated her with oyster shells. Oh, God, you know, I mean, skinned a woman alive with oyster shells. And so she became a pagan martyr. By the way, if you want to see this, although they won't show you the way she died, mercifully they spare you that. There's a movie with Rachel Weisz called Agora. That's Agora, Agora. And this is the story of Hypatia. And it's a beautiful film. Alexandria then, after the library got burned, and finally, I guess, about the Greek Ptolemaic era phased right into the Roman era. You remember Cleopatra was the last, she was the last of the Ptolemies. And Cleopatra was a brilliant woman. I mean, she spoke, read and spoke about five languages, and she was very, very well educated, and she wanted to, you know, to reestablish and to establish Greco-Egyptian culture. And of course, she teamed up with Antony in that civil war, and both of them went down. But she was the last of the, you know, of the Greek rulership, so to speak, of Alexandria. And after that, it became Egypto-Roman. And it continued on in one way or another. Alexandria continued all the way up to the fall of the Roman Empire. Although by that time the library had already been burned twice, but they still, you know, it still had its reputation up until finally when the Arabs came in, and then there was this Caliph Omar, I believe he was, and he made the famous statement, or infamous statement. You know, there are certain infamous statements in history, and I think Omar's is one of the most infamous. He said, "Well, if these books agree with the Quran, we don't need them, and if they don't agree with the Quran, we don't want them, so let's burn them all." And they stoked the fires for days and days and days with the last of the great Alexandrian libraries as a result of that. I think I'll say that the other way around, though. If they don't agree with the Quran, we don't want them. And if they do agree, we don't need them. So off they went. Zawi Hawass right now is offering replicas of his hat for sale. He thinks he's the new Indiana Jones, and he's replicating. I don't know. Maybe Zawi Hawass's hat and Omar's turban ought to be put together in a museum somewhere. But the Alexandrian tradition, however, and this is what we really want to point out, is that Kabbalah, Jewish Kabbalah, sure, it got more and more and more Judified as it progressed. And until finally, by the time the Zohar was written, it was pretty much all taken out of the Talmud and the Torah and whatever. But Originally, the Kabbalah was, the structure was Pythagorean. A Sephiroth Zero was Pythagorean. And another thing that we want to mention too is that the whole concept of alphanumeric correspondences was originally Greek. And the reason why the Hebrew Kabbalah, even with it, now Hebrew Kabbalah has a deficiency, which Shalom admits, over the Greek Kabbalah in the sense that it only has 22 letters. Well, you need 24 letters. You need a 24-letter alphabet in order to have a letter for Earth, and in order to have enough letters to get around the zodiac. So you can actually have a zodiacal analog that is alphanumeric. Now, I know that doesn't sound, to some people that may not sound important, but believe me, it is. And in fact, the fellow who really kind of came up with the first Kabbalah, and of course the first version of the Enochian tablets, if you want to look at it that way, was a Gnostic by the name of Marcus, who was a student of Valentinian, and he's the one who put the Greek alphabet right on the signs of the zodiac, and that had a lot to do with the structure, with the original structure of the Kabbalah. Now, one of the things, though, that you should realize, that the Greek Kabbalah lost out to the Hebrew Kabbalah for a basic reason. And the basic reason is that the Greek is an inflected language, and Hebrew is not. This means that Hebrew... You take a piece of Hebrew, and it doesn't matter too much what the tense or what the or the case or the tense or anything or the ending is. It's still going to be the same. Whereas if you take a piece of Greek, then you are into so many arbitrary interpretations because of the fact that it is inflected that it becomes very cumbersome and not very easy to interpolate. So therefore, the Hebrew Kabbalah won out by default. Even and becomes a lot easier for us to use, but the Hebrew Kabbalah was diverged from the Greek, and then it reintegrated in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance. It reintegrated with the Rosicrucian tradition, and it reintegrated, and then eventually became what we call the Hermetic Kabbalah or the Rosicrucian Kabbalah. And you could say, if you want to, you could say, well, the Zoharic Kabbalah is purer and more in tune with just the Bible and whatever and all that. You could say that. But then on the other hand, look where it came from. And I think that we should realize that we have this synthesis. By the way, alchemy was another one of these Hermetic aspects to Egyptian originally. Alchemy, out of Chem, Alchemia. Out of the land of Chem. But alchemy retained its Greek correspondences and did not integrate very well. You have a hard time integrating alchemy with Kabbalah. In fact, the Golden Dawn finally found one old Jewish manuscript that did kind of halfway get there, so at least they managed to do that. That was the Ajman's Ref. But alchemy doesn't quite measure up. Astrology does, and we're still trying, we're still putting this whole synthesis back together, actually. And like I said in the abstract, this original Alexandrian synthesis was finally codified by Abbot Trithemius and Cornelius Agrippa in the 16th century. Well, they did quite a job. They put all of these disparate elements together and tried as much as they could to, you know, to put them into a practical system. And then the Golden Dawn came along several hundred years later and improved on it. You know, still haven't got it completely right, but we try to make pickle these elements that were originally put together, originally came together in Alexandria way back around the time of Christ. That's when. Now, one more thing I'd like to mention, though, that this had this whole Alexandrian Hermetic proposition, Neoplatonic proposition, had an influence on Christianity, even though Christianity tried its best for a while to destroy it, but it actually had quite an influence, because once the Christians did gain power, and once they did become the religion for the Western world, then there they had some scholars and some church fathers who really were fascinated by all of this. And so the early Catholic Church became Neoplatonic in its philosophy. And then they started, once they defeated the pagans, once they really had them defeated, that's when they started adapting a lot of this Alexandrian synthesis into Christianity. And now there's a book, and I'd like to suggest this. This is a wonderful book, by the way. It's called Jesus Christ, Son of God. And the Son is spelled S-U-N of God. Because, as you remember, Hermetic and Greco-Egyptian religion is solar-oriented. Jewish religion is Saturnian. Okay, but Hermetic religion, Egyptian Hermetic and Greco-Egyptian religion is solar-oriented. And so the Greeks took Christianity over. I mean, they Greekified it. They made it, you know, Paul and Constantine and the rest of them, they turned it into a Greek religion. So they made Jesus a sun god. And then they started using all this Alexandrian philosophy we've been talking about, Hermetic philosophy, and they began to secretly, and not so secretly, infuse it into Christian philosophy. Now, this book is called Jesus Christ, Son of God, Ancient Cosmology and Early Christian Symbolism. It's by David Fiedler, who also happens to be the editor, or was the editor, of Alexandria, the Alexandria Journal. And Alexandria Journal is still available. You can still get them. They're I don't think they're in print anymore, but the Alexandria Journal by Fanish Press. And they run articles on what we've been talking about tonight. And wonderful, wonderful articles in this journal on the phases of Hermetic philosophy. One other book I would like to recommend to, once again, that I've said many, many times, if you really want to get a handle on Hermetic philosophy and really, really do it right, really get the best, a little book called The Way of Hermes, and it's published by Inner Traditions. It's called The Way of Hermes. Don't ask me who the authors are. There's about five of them, and I can't pronounce any of their names, but it's called The Way of Hermes, and this is a marvelous little book, and it really give you a grasp on Hermetic philosophy. So that's our heritage from Alexandria,
coming all the way down to the present time.
Too bad we couldn't have a conference in Alexandria. We're going to have a big conference in Alexandria, and then the Arab Spring took over, and that kind of got short-circuited. But who knows how long that's going to last. But next week, we're going to have a very interesting show next week. I just got a book that was
published back in 1938, and David Childress ran off and reprinted it, called Darkness Over Tibet. And this is a fascinating book. It's complete fiction, but it apparently had some influence on the Nazis, and it brings up some very interesting points about a number of things. So what we're going to deal with is Darkness Over Tibet, and we're going to also talk about the real dark side of Buddhism, the real dark side of Eastern magic, as opposed to what this fellow has fictionalized in this book, and then what his agenda was in fictionalizing it. It's going to be an interesting show. So next week, Darkness Over Tibet, and meanwhile, good magic.